I'm Benjamin Wittes, editor-in-chief of Lawfare.
And I'm Susan Hennessy, managing editor of Lawfare.
You're listening to Rational Security on the ER podcast feed.
For more of our columns and exclusive Lawfare content, read us at foreignpolicy.com.
So, Tamara, do you have an email you'd like to read with class?
I think a lot of establishment Washington has been enjoying this a little bit too much, but I can't help myself.
Not enough.
Last night, Chris Hayes broke the story of two emails that were sent out to the Secret Service and White House security, the White House security distro list, an hour before Sebastian Gorka announced via the Federalist that he was resigning his post.
Quote, resigning.
Yes, unquote. The first email was, subject, staff, do not admit. Please notify officers of the following staff do not admit. Sebastian L. Gorka, EOP, that's Executive Office of the President, blue pass holder. And then a half an hour later, another email, subject line, staff do not admit Gorka. Mr. Gorka, no, not Dr. Gorka, sorry, Seb. Mr. Gorka is more than likely still in possession of his PIV and the White House pass, as his do not admit status was performed without him being on complex.
Wow. Ouch! Cold! Is there like a picture of like, if you see this man, close the gates?
But I want to point out that he was on Fox News this morning talking about the reasons why, quote, I resigned.
Because if you say it enough times with enough confidence, people will believe you. This is his whole shtick. It's been his shtick his whole career.
Yeah. So his next project is making sure the history is that he resigned.
Look, I just want to say that, you know, I think that for somebody who is basically universally viewed as a joke among his peers.
And a charlatan,
that hanging on in the White House for 6 months is a real accomplishment. And Sebastian Gorka, I think you should be proud of yourself.
You beat Mike Flynn.
Anthony
Scaramucci.
Priebus, you know, you hold your head high. Coming in the White House. They aren't going to let you there.
And I invited him on the Lawfare podcast. Haven't gotten a response, but yeah, I meant it most sincerely, and I would love to have Sebastian Gorka, if you're listening, in the Jungle Studio for a wide-ranging conversation about all kinds of things. We have lots of areas of mutual interest.
Including how you totally broke up with the White House. They didn't break up with you.
Yeah, and we'll discuss those emails.
You can't fire me. I quit.
Among other things.
The best tweet I saw on this was somebody observing that maybe he'd blocked so many people on Twitter that he didn't know he'd been fired.
Hello, welcome to Rational Security, the No Morka edition. I'm Shane Harris, fake news reporter. We're going to miss Seb Gorka.
We're not going to have Seb Gorka to kick around anymore.
Actually, but we're going to have him, he's going to be constantly on the news.
That's the problem. He's going to go on the lecture circuit. He's going to make a lot of money. Yeah. Never going away.
Does anyone know, was his wife also removed from DHS?
I haven't seen any reports. I think she's still there and doing the Lord's work against the CVE.
He made an interesting...
Yeah, keeping the country safe from CVE.
He made an interesting reference where he said, I can't remember if this was in a tweet or if it was in a statement, but that to Breitbart, that he felt that he and his family could do more work from the outside than the inside, which made me think, wait a second, has Kathleen Gorka left as well, or is there now a private-public alliance that has been formed in the Gorka household around these issues?
A very interesting question.
Something to keep in mind to keep an eye on in the future.
Something to investigate.
The Gorka family operations.
I'm here in the Jungle Studio with my friends Tamara Kaufman, Wittes, Ben Wittes, and Susan Hennessy. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
And we have a special guest this week.
We do.
A deep state denizen.
Yes.
Has joined us from an unspecified agency following a posting in an unspecified foreign country. So, wave hello, Deep State Denison.
Hello, Deep State. We're very
great
glad to
have
you
here.
It's a full house today in the Jungle Studio. All right, this week on the podcast, Donald Trump was pursuing business in Russia at the same time he was running for president. Weren't they all doing that? Two cabinet secretaries distanced themselves from the president. And is it time for the House to start seriously considering impeachment? At least one rational security panelist thinks so. Plus object lessons. Let's start with the news that I guess the Washington Post broke and then was followed up by the Times and also the Journal that in the late period of 2015 into early January 2016, after Trump had announced that he was running for president, he was, in the form of the Trump Organization, I should say, pursuing a licensing deal with a company in Moscow where they would build a building that would put his name on it, following a pretty typical pattern that Trump does when he sells his name to other properties. It ultimately did not materialize, but not for lack of trying on the part of Trump and his associates. And we learned yesterday that Michael Cohen, the Trump Organization attorney, in a sort of, maybe he would characterize it as a Hail Mary effort to get the Russian government to help get this process that was stalling moving along, sent an email to Dmitry Peskov, who is the head of press relations and sort of a right-hand kind of figure to Vladimir Putin. So totally normal, doing business in Russia, trying to enlist the Kremlin to help us.
That way.
Nothing to see here. Didn't materialize at all. So obviously it's a pretty significant story, Ben, insofar as this now does more than suggest. It demonstrates that while the president may have not had business dealings in Russia, he was certainly pursuing business dealings in Russia when he was seeking the White House.
Yeah, so I think there's two distinct and important things about this story, and I'm going to treat it as one story, though each of the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal all have added facts to it over the last 48 hours. But let's treat it as a single story for present purposes. Seems to me there's two things that are important about it. The first is this is yet another set of contacts between people in the Trump orbit and people representing the Russian government or people close to the Russian government. And that comes on top of, I mean, the list is getting long now, right? Everybody and his mother's meeting with the Russian ambassador. It comes on top of that meeting in which mysteriously Jared Kushner seems to have tried to create a back channel, right, to the Russian state. It comes on top of the meeting in Trump Tower in which the child of the president tried, you know, took a meeting to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. It comes on top of the attempt by this junior staffer, George Papadopoulos, to schedule a meeting between Trump and Putin that didn't come to anything. And it comes on top of additional efforts by another staffer to to connect the campaign and the Russian government. And that's before we get to the story that you, Shane, broke, which is the bizarre set of connections between Peter Smith and possibly the more institutional Trump campaign. So, I mean, what we're seeing emerge is a remarkable pattern of direct communications and indirect communications that would frankly make any intelligence agency really scratch its head. The second area, and what I think makes this story different from the prior ones, is that this story does involve a direct ask by the Trump Organization of the Russian government. That is, it's not through some intermediary. It's a lawyer representing the Trump Organization writes an email to Dmitry Peskov. And by the way, that's the same Dmitry Peskov who the other day was quoted by Sputnik saying that I'm not a real journalist and the attorney and Putin shouldn't fight me.
Well, you are defrocked.
I am, yeah, and so I just want to point out that Peskov's hands is in all parts of this story.
He's coming for you.
He's coming for me. You know, this was a situation where somebody representing Trump wrote to this press spokesman for the president of Russia and asked him to intervene to make a business deal happen, and in the middle of the campaign. And that's extraordinary.
So I think one of the, like, I think sort of the most significant thing, because I'm not sure that this is, it's sort of, it's another shoe falling, but is not exactly a bombshell revelation, right? He does reach out to Dmitry Peskov, but he uses like the generic sort of, you know, press at Kremlin kind of address. And so it's possible to read the evidence as saying, well, you know, there was intent, but maybe there wasn't the kind of very close access. But it's just what unbelievable liars these people were. The Russia issue was a major issue towards the end of the campaign. We had lots and lots of conversations as a nation. And President Trump addressed the country and made a series of factual statements. I have no business with Russia. There's no connection with Russia.
I have
nothing to do with Russia. His campaign surrogates, his kids, the people who eventually would take senior positions in his administration, they went on national television, they went on rally stages, and they made these representations to the American people. And all along, this was going on. And so the thing that's so incredible to me is to sort of rewind the tape and look at the representations that they were making at that moment and look at what they knew, what we know they knew. And even if, you know, this is not some nefarious thing, it's not a huge criminal conspiracy, to me it is just an utterly shocking scandal that you can have a lie, just a demonstrable, verifiable lie on that scale, and somehow we're not seeing sort of the accountability mechanisms kicking into place.
I think that's exactly right. It's not a slam dunk. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with collusion over the campaign itself, but it's the duplicitousness, it's the dishonesty, and the sort of insistence upon it at every step of the way that's so striking. I think the other thing that came through to me from the reporting and then from the emails of Felix Satter, this Russian-American intermediary who was kind of talent spotting, I guess, or opportunity spotting for the Trump organization, is that even if Trump himself or his own lawyer were not, you know, thinking about connections between business and Russia and this incipient presidential campaign, their intermediary was and was writing very explicitly about how it's great to do these things together, to do business in Russia and elect Trump president.
And we're going to get him elected.
Yeah. Right. And that doing business in Russia would help get him elected
right.
president.
That's the key.
And so, you know, I think that all that underscores the point that you're making, Susan, that, you know, there's simply no way that these guys, well, I just didn't remember meeting the Russians, or the Russians have nothing to do with this campaign. You know, when they're getting emails like this from a close business partner, it's simply not credible for them to make those kinds of claims. And so, hypocrisy is normal in politics. And the public, of course, already knew that Trump liked Putin and was interested in doing business in Russia. So in that sense, there's nothing shockingly new here. Precisely what's upsetting about it is that it's not new. It's so consistent. It is so much a facet of the way he
behaves. Ben wants to jump in here, but I just want to key in on one point, too, before you do, which is that I think you pointed to Felix Sater, who has this longstanding relationship with the Trump organization, even though Donald Trump claims that he couldn't pick him out of a lineup, although he had an office in Donald Trump's office at one point.
And a business card for the Trump organization.
Correct. I mean, to me, one of the more fascinating and just deeply intriguing statements on the part of Felix Sater, who is not a nobody, both in Russia and in the Trump world, is this statement that, and we're going to get him elected, and
right.
clearly indicate, more than indicating, saying that the business opportunity we're pursuing is going to get him elected. That needs to be more explained. That doesn't seem like a casual reference. That strikes me as something that he said with some backstory, perhaps, in mind. It just I'm going next.
I actually disagree with Tamara that this may be unconnected to the collusion suggestions. I mean, let's tick off the sequence of events, right? In the fall leading to January of 2000, 2015, leading to January 2016. The Trump Organization is actively pursuing a deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow that the broker for the deal, Felix Sater, specifically says this is going to cultivate relations with Putin and get Trump elected. In that period of time, Trump is repeatedly asked to call Putin what he is, which is an authoritarian, murderous dictator. And he repeatedly refuses and says nice things about Putin. That even as the deal falls apart, Putin starts saying nice things about Trump. And they develop this very public bromance all through the period of the Republican primaries, toward the end of which we have this spree of other contacts that include the Russian government through this lawyer coming to talk about adoption with a promise that to get the meeting, that this is part of the Russian government's support of candidate Trump and his presidential campaign and promise to deliver dirt on Hillary Clinton. That meeting does not produce dirt, but shortly thereafter, the Russian government, having hacked the DNC, unloads the material to WikiLeaks in a fashion that, in fact, is quite damaging to Hillary Clinton's campaign. Now, I don't think you have to be a crazy conspiracy theorist to ask, is this an isolated, unrelated series of events that all happen to involve the Trump campaign, the Trump organization, Donald Trump personally, and people close to Vladimir Putin? And by the way, at some point in this, Felix Sater arranges for Ivanka Trump literally to sit in Vladimir Putin's chair, right? Or is this a public, semi-public, and private dance of a sort of mating ritual between these two entities and public figures in which that leads Vladimir Putin to decide, let's screw Hillary Clinton and help this guy? And I think that is just not an implausible question to be asking at this point.
You know, I'm not going to disagree with any of that. I think that we still face two questions to which we don't yet have the answers. One is, even if that was Putin's play, was it Trump's? And the other is, you know, do the American public and their representatives in Congress care enough to do anything about it?
Well, that's a different question. I agree with you. That's the mother of all questions. But I do think if you're analyzing factually, what does the emerging pattern of contacts, what story does it tell? I think it's important to look at them all in the context of one another, rather than to say, oh, this happened months earlier, it's probably irrelevant. It was the Trump organization, not the Trump campaign, it's probably irrelevant. I think we're looking at a pattern, a long pattern with a lot of data points of flirtation between Trump and Putin.
We've talked about it a little bit before, but the proverbial boiled frog, that hearing it all at once really is overwhelming. But because we have sort of this slow drip, 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 you know, new story every couple of weeks, it becomes hard to fully appreciate the magnitude because the story is being visited upon us relatively slowly. And it's only whenever you sort of step back and look at the full pattern that it really becomes just astonishing, overwhelming, unbelievable.
It really, it suggests that when Bob Mueller is ready finally to make his report, it's going to require an act of narrative crafting to make sense of this all for people and for members of Congress and in a way that's meaningful.
And we'll talk more about some of these issues in the third segment, but let's talk next about what was a pretty remarkable pair of statements. I thought actually there were three statements, but we'll talk about two in particular in the past few days by Rex Tillerson and Jim Mattis, in which both of them seem to pretty clearly put a lot of daylight between themselves and the president over the issue of his response to the violence in Charlottesville. Tillerson was on Fox News Sunday, and Chris Wallace asked him whether or not Trump's response, and we don't have to relitigate that, but made it more difficult for Tillerson to represent American values. And do you think that it was more difficult for for America to represent these sort of values of inclusiveness and civil rights? And Tillerson responds by saying, look, I've talked to the State Department about our commitment to values and how we will go on expressing them and representing.
Never mind that he denigrated that when he was speaking to members of the department at the beginning of his term in office.
Right.
Maybe he's coming around.
He may be coming around. This is that he said, but then Wallace pressed him and said, but does the president saying that both sides share blame for violence represent? Make it more difficult to represent American values, to which Tillerson replied, the president speaks for himself.
Mic drop.
And Chris Wallace, visibly stunned, said, are you separating yourself from the president? And Tillerson replied, I've made my home comment as to our values. So there was that. And then also a video surfaced of Jim Mattis talking to a small group of troops. It's not clear in which country he was speaking with them. It was pretty informal. It looked like it was maybe shot on a phone. Where Mattis says, our country right now, it's got problems we don't have in the military. You just hold the line until our country gets back to understanding and respecting each other and showing it. The power of inspiration. We'll get the power of inspiration back. Add to that, Gary Cohn, the economic advisor, telling the Financial Times that the Trump administration had not done nearly enough to repudiate white supremacy and anti-Semitism and had lots more work to do. So these are two cabinet secretaries, or two national security chiefs, as it were, really taking a big step back from the president. And I mean, you could, as this was coming across on Sunday, some of us in the newsroom were even looking at it saying, is Rex Tillerson saying that the president of the United States does not speak for the United States? And Tamara, what do you make of it?
Well, so first of all, I think that whether you're looking at it as a matter of constitutional or legal authority or as a matter of symbolism and messaging, of course, the president speaks for the United States. Of course, the president speaks for the executive branch. And that's precisely what made Tillerson's statement so extraordinary. It's also precisely what made the president's statements so damaging. And that's why Tillerson apparently felt compelled to say what he said. Look, I don't think that any of these guys is speaking out of deep, principled conviction. Well, I don't want to say that they're not at all, but if that were their primary motivator, one could ask why they took the job in the first place with a man as unprincipled as President Trump, and they knew what they were getting into. So I think that what's going on here is, I think there are a couple of possible interpretations. One is we've seen reporting around, discussions between Kelly and Mattis, and potentially Kelly, Mattis, McMaster, and Tillerson being a sort of coalition trying to constrain some of the worst instincts of the White House on foreign policy and national security affairs. So one possibility is that this is kind of action in concert to contain the damage abroad of the president's statements. Another possibility is that each of these guys individually is making an assessment of what's required for them to remain effective in their jobs as long as they stay in their jobs, and that there's a certain amount of distancing that they need to do in order to be able to speak credibly themselves. And part of that calculation is that he's not going to fire them over it. And frankly, I think that's probably a pretty good calculation for them at this point. It would create another crisis. It's not clear he could get anyone to replace them. It's not clear that if he could name people to replace them, that they would get through the Senate. And so I think they've, Mattis and Tillerson are probably making a pretty decent bet right now that they can separate themselves, give themselves a little more room to act and get away with it. The question I have is whether it makes any damn difference, frankly, for their effectiveness in their jobs. And then finally, I'll just make one side point about Mattis's statements. We've talked a lot on the show about civil-military relations in this administration. And, I found it a bit troubling, although, I appreciate the sentiment he was expressing. I know colleagues of mine who worked in the Defense Department found it more troubling the extent to which Mattis was saying, look, we uniformed military folks can be the guardians of American national values while the rest of American society is all screwed up. There was a little Praetorian Guard element of that that made me uncomfortable.
So this is actually sort of the topic of Ben and my column for this week for foreign policy, right, sort of Madison Tillerson's comments and what it means. And I think, Tammy, is it her, your point about that they don't think they're going to get fired is exactly the right one. Either they don't think they're going to get fired or they don't care if they're going to get fired, because you know, our column is really about sort of the like death of the unitary executive, and that we really aren't supposed to be seeing this happen. You aren't supposed to see cabinet and sub-cabinet officials contradicting everything that the president says. The president is supposed to be the executive branch. There are all kinds of positive reasons for that. And that this really isn't an argument about what kind of authorities the president should have, which is a longstanding sort of ideological debate, but really is about whether or not the president can effectively discharge his authority, which is not a controversial subject or hasn't been a controversial subject. And so this sort of, while on one hand, I like I think most people in this room, welcome what we're seeing, which is responsible adults standing up and speaking on out on behalf of American values. There is sort of an element of that's disturbing about it, and that's that this isn't the way the American government is supposed to function. This isn't the way this is all supposed to work. And one of the reasons why we do have this sort of tight unitary structure in which the president is the head and everybody else is just sort of the arms and limbs is because of accountability. Because whenever one person has all the ultimate power, one person has all the ultimate responsibility. And right now we're in a situation in which we don't know who to believe whenever Trump versus members of his cabinet say things. And I think ultimately that does risk creating a situation in which the American people also don't know who to hold ultimately accountable for a decision. And that the real question and the one that we, you know, pose in this column is, you know, whether or not this is occurring just as kind of a feature of the Trump presidency, or if this is actually kind of the changing nature of the office, right? He's going to fundamentally alter the nature of the American presidency.
So I want to say, I mean, my head has, I have a lot of thoughts on this subject, and I'm going to try to
a whole only, book's worth of thoughts, yeah, gonna, as a matter of fact.
try to be disciplined and make only one of them. But first of all, I do think it is really worth pausing over just how offensive this set of behaviors is to the very notion of a unitary executive. And I say that as someone who's delighted that it's happening. But we got to keep in mind the idea that this really isn't the way the presidency is supposed to work. And when the presidency says something as an expression of his values, the Secretary of State does not get to say the president does not speak for me. That should just never happen. And it's a mark of the degree of dysfunction that this executive is seeing, that not only does that happen, not only does Nikki Haley go on every talk show and contradict the president on every issue of foreign policy, but that we actually cheer whenever it happens. That's a really weird situation. Number two, it is a situation that is entirely driven, or largely driven, almost entirely driven, as Tamara says, by the perception that people will not be fired. And the unitary executive is a function of the president's appointment power and the collateral ability to remove people from office, that you have to follow the president's orders because he will fire you if you don't. And Trump is a supposed tough guy, but everybody has picked up that he's actually a wuss and he actually won't fire people. And the most dramatic example of this, and by the way, the one that's most clearly principled in contrast to Tillerson, who did, as Tamara says, make the bed and lay in it, is Chuck Rosenberg, who's the head of the DEA on an acting basis. And when the president went out and said, you know, that it's okay to smash heads together when you arrest somebody, Chuck Rosenberg sent an email to the entire DEA that said, no, it's not. And that was almost immediately leaked, I believe, to the Wall Street Journal. You know, he basically said, this is not a reflection of our values.
And notably, he's not a Trump appointee.
He is not a Trump appointee, and he was not removed. And if you do that over and over again, as staff, you know, as senior administration officials have, and nobody gets fired for countermanding the president's orders, then the unitary executive takes a big beating.
Boy. Let's use this actually then to segue into our third topic. This feels like a natural kind of point to do that. So, Ben, you and Jane Chong wrote an essay in Lawfare this week. It was on Monday, which I encourage everyone to go read, saying that it is now time for Congress to begin a formal impeachment inquiry. You don't have to go through every chapter and verse of the argument, but essentially I think you sum it up in the end when you quote Justice Joseph Story saying that impeachment is not limited to crimes of a strictly legal character and that has what he says is a more enlarged operation and reaches what are aptly termed political offenses growing out of personal misconduct or gross neglect or usurpation or habitual disregard for the public interests, various in their character and so indefinable in their actual involutions that it is almost impossible to provide systematically for them by positive law. And you and Jane summed up by saying this is a near perfect description of Trump's wide-ranging abuses and the challenge that now lies with Congress. The order that the positive law is unable to provide is now its to impose. So I jump from where we were to this because there is a process for addressing the behaviors that Tillerson and Mattis and Rosenberg and Cohen and Nikki Haley, et cetera, seem to be are clearly responding to. And why do you all think that now is the moment for the House, the Republican House, to formally take that up and start organizing what you see as those offenses in a way that leads to the question of whether to form articles of impeachment?
So it's a very interesting question what the date was on which I would have said, well, a reasonable member of Congress should be thinking in the language of impeachment. By the way, that's different than saying the reasonable member of Congress would vote to impeach, but that the mental rubric in which you're thinking as a member of Congress who takes your oath of office seriously has to be, should we think about, should we impeach the president? So I've actually believed that for a while. But I have been struck recently, particularly in the wake of Charlottesville, by how few elected officials, frankly, of either party, are talking about it in this language. And so, you know, my view, at least since the revelations around the Comey firing and the obstructions of justice leading up to it, was that this was something that Congress should be thinking about. But I've been really struck after Charlottesville when there's this sort of universal condemnation of the president's behavior as raising a question about the fitness of him to lead morally, whether, you know, that the known vocabulary for such discussion, which is the impeachment clauses, don't really figure in a serious way into the conversation, except in certain hashtags. And so my point is, if you have a serious question as a member of Congress about the president's fundamental fitness, there is actually a vocabulary for that, and there is actually a known process for thinking about that, and we should trigger those and talk in those terms. And then that raises the question, should we have fundamental questions about the fitness of the president for office? And the answer to that question is, duh.
So I think it's a great essay and it's very persuasive and I don't disagree with its arguments. I do think as a political matter, you are suggesting that one branch of government should take an interest in preventing the dysfunction, in halting the dysfunction and preventing the weakening of another branch of government. And of course, that's the way the Constitution is designed. That's why we have this these impeachment clauses. And that's what we would wish public-minded members of Congress to do. But as a political matter, you know, it's an interesting question whether it's what they want to do. The Republicans, because they are Republicans and this is a Republican executive, and the Democrats, because at least some of them, maybe I don't know about the elected ones, but a lot of activists think it's better to have the Trump administration crash and burn and fail and destroy things, because that means Democrats will be elected ever after, or at least that's the theory. Whereas, you know, who has the interest in halting this decline? It's those within the executive branch. I mean, from a political perspective. And, you know, Shane, you mentioned earlier before we started taping that these Tillerson and Mattis statements raise the question of the 25th Amendment. Ben, you raised the question of fitness in office, and that's what the 25th Amendment's all about.
Well, the 25th Amendment's about disability. Trump is many things. I don't actually think he's disabled.
Well, don't you think you can actually take that? I mean, I think you would probably, if I were to pull your various arguments on this front, including way back when Trump was inaugurated and you said, let's face it, the guy has a clinical problem.
Well, that was a year before he was inaugurated.
That's true. I guess that was.
I described in March of 2016 evident clinical symptoms.
Evident clinical symptoms, yes. You know, I think it's easy to imagine a world in which people openly debate what the idea of disability means and whether there is enough flex in the 25th Amendment to actually use it in the same way that during Watergate, people had a discussion about impeachment, which hadn't happened since the days of Andrew Johnson. And we were in totally new territory in that respect. And people, you know, members of Congress in a fairly bipartisan fashion, which you don't have now, came to some agreement about what impeachment was. And you guys write about Charles Black's sort of handbook for this in your essay. I would argue that in the scenario we're in now, neither the 25th Amendment nor impeachment is likely, but the 25th Amendment removal option is more likely than impeachment.
Why,
though?
I actually think
our colleague Molly Reynolds has written a little bit about this, actually, sort of the calculus of members of Congress to remove a president of their own party, and sort of the politically realist answer is that they only make that decision when they are either concerned about losing their own seats or whenever they're concerned about losing control of Congress. Essentially, that they decide to impeach or investigate or take action against a president of their own party when it is worse for them not to, and the costs of not acting are higher for them, and that it really is a pretty craven calculation on both part of the House and the Senate. And so I do think that it's all ultimately connected, right? As we see those approval numbers coming down, as he does crazier and crazier things that make larger and larger parts of sort of the Republican electorate feel deeply uncomfortable. But that ultimately, the relevant metric here is not that 60% of Americans support impeachment. And the relevant metric is not even how crazy it gets. The only relevant metric is how scared is each individual Republican member of Congress for his own electoral prospects or that of his caucus. And they are not scared enough yet.
So I want to hear Shane's argument for why the 25th Amendment, while unlikely, is more likely than impeachment, because I think we can all understand why impeachment is unlikely.
Right. I think that, and I've thought that for a while, and I feel more confident in that prediction, although if that is, again, both of these are remote possibilities, after hearing Tillerson and Mattis, and I think there's a growing body of evidence that suggests that these men may, in fact, see themselves as buffers between chaos and a functioning government, and might actually be the kind of people who would come forward and entertain this possibility. I just think that in the Republican House of Representatives right now, there's zero political will for this. I do think if by some happenstance Republicans did vote to impeach him, or the Democrats took over the House in 2019 and voted to impeach, I think a Republican Senate would be likely to actually remove him, because I think there's more of a building bipartisan consensus around Trump in the Senate than there is in the House. But it seems almost unthinkable that House Republicans, led by Paul Ryan, at this point, even with all that they have seen, would vote to impeach the president. We haven't seen the level of outrage and concern that you have clearly seen in members of his cabinet, who would have to come forward and engage in this extraordinary effort to remove him. Again, two very remote. I mean, the fact that I think impeachment is almost impossible, I put 25th Amendment just a little more likely than that, because I think neither's going to happen. But I think the conditions are actually...
Well, it's a smaller number of people.
It's a smaller number of people. And I think it's more likely, given what we've seen in the reactions that people have had to all the things that we've been talking for the past 8 months that the president has done.
So, look, I don't disagree with you as a political predictive matter about what's likely. I will say this. If you ask me as a constitutional matter, should the cabinet invoke the 25th Amendment, I think that is extremely dicey territory.
Yeah.
If you ask me as a normative constitutional matter, should the House of Representatives be thinking in the language of impeachment, the answer to that question is obviously to me, yes.
Right.
And so I think, you know—
And actually, a politically more palatable and safer route to go right now.
Oh,
well, and the most
if you put a gun to Washington's head and said 25th Amendment or impeachment inquiry, obviously you would choose the impeachment inquiry.
Well, and of course, if given the option, I think everyone would prefer to see Trump voted out of office. That's the most legitimate, the most stabilizing.
Well, and his supporters would, let's be clear too, that is the route that, I mean, everybody, I think, would favor is there being an election. Because if you're removed by 25th Amendment, who knows how
well,
the public
and the other,
would
remember,
react to that.
25th Amendment is temporary removal. And so it's as a, you know, assuming it were appropriate and constitutional to do, which I have real doubts about, it doesn't actually solve the problem. I mean, you know, he's still the president. He's just not acting as the president until he, you know, people sort of declare him fit again, whatever that means. It puts you in a very, very difficult sort of palace coup kind of environment. Look, the right answer to this problem is the impeachment process. And if you are right, and I suspect you are, that Congress is not able or willing, we can invoke Ashley Deeks and the unable or unwilling test, then the right answer to that problem is to demand it of them as a democratic expectation matter. And if they don't deliver, to replace them in a year with people who will. And you know, the right answer is not to revert to a shortcut constitutional process that was not designed for this situation. Remember, Donald Trump is not crazier than he was when people voted for him.
I mean, I think that's actually a really, really important point, that this was all on full display and he was elected. And so whenever we think about the appropriate mechanisms, even impeachment, that this, you know, there really is an expectation of there has to be new information. There has to be some sort of new understanding. Otherwise, you know, look, I could shoot someone in Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for me. And
maybe
we had
right.
a set of information yeah. about Donald Trump before the election. He was voted into office.
Right. And that, by the way, is why nowhere in that piece do Jane and I talk about grab them by the pussy or any of the many things that I would think of are as impeachable offenses that Trump committed before being elected president. You get a pass on all of that stuff for impeachment purposes because the people get to price that into their vote.
But if that's
vote.
The case, then doesn't that mean that anything he may have done to collude with the Russians to swing the election is off
the table? No, because it's whether we knew about it or not. It's whether voters knew about it when they voted. And I think that's the point, is if there's stuff that is uncovered since, and then, of course, he's doubled down on it by firing Comey and so on. Those are acts that compound things that were hidden before the election.
And just to bring it full circle, I think that's why the original stories we were talking about are so important.
Correct.
Because it was lies about information that was known before the election, which sort of invalidates the principle that, well, it was before and therefore it doesn't count.
Right.
Impeachment is fundamentally about offenses committed in office that make the perpetrator dangerous in office. And, you know, the 25th Amendment is about the state of the person, right? Whether it's that he's been shot.
But
and
not
is
the nature of the person.
Right, but not the nature of the person to the extent.
Hold on, though. What if, I mean, and now I'm going to sound like I'm being flip here, but I mean this in a serious way. What if the president then just goes out tomorrow and just starts speaking in absolute gibberish on the podium.
So I
is evincing signs of some kind of a mental breakdown. And then the next day, no, I'm fine. And then he starts tweeting kafefik, and going back and forth. You know what I'm getting at?
I am not arguing that under no circumstances could mental disability be a basis for a 25th
Amendment. But how would you
diagnose
that?
I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I know for sure that Trump has engaged in conduct that a reasonable Congress should be evaluating as a matter of impeachment. And so I think the 25th Amendment stuff is really dicey territory. I don't know what the answer to it is. The impeachment stuff, I know what the right answer is.
What if he launches a preemptive strike on North Korean nuclear facilities that all of his advisors have cautioned him against and 100,000 people are killed as a result?
He's violated international law, potentially.
Right, but he's still the president and he gets to do that.
Well, I guess what we're getting at is that with the 25th Amendment, I mean, it may be that you need to be visibly like incapacitated, in a coma for this thing to trigger, right? That simple, like stark raving mad doesn't count.
So that was certainly the issue that gave rise to it. Remember, the 25th Amendment follows the Kennedy assassination and people rightly got worried, what if he hadn't died? Right. What if he'd just been shot and was in a coma and, you know, was still the president? There's no mechanism for turning things over to Lyndon Johnson in that situation. That was the situation that gave rise to the 25th Amendment. It wasn't really about what if the president is a frickin' nutcase.
Elections
and
have,
by the way, we may
y'all
need a second a constitutional amendment to think about that problem, because the 25th Amendment actually doesn't do a very good job with
it. The polity is definitely equipped to take that on right now. Woo! All right, let's move on to object lessons. I'll briefly do mine. We had a sign of things to come. The moon blotted out the sun in Washington recently.
The sky darkened.
The birds sang their night songs in the middle of the day. I know the eclipse is like totally over, whatever, but I'm going to brag because my husband took the most awesome photos of it. Here's one.
Wow.
Not good.
That
looks like NASA quality. I think in one of the shots, he may have actually photographed the space station.
I think we should
crossing
use that.
The sun because it did that.
Yeah, it did that. Like there's the, you can compare
it. It did a photo bomb on everybody's
eclipse
photo. Yeah,
totally
photobombed
that. But this was, you put a little filter on the lens cap and it was delightful.
Beautiful.
He's just so talented, that husband of yours.
Yeah, when the apocalypse comes, I'll grow all the vegetables and he'll document it.
When's he going to come on the show?
He should totally come on the show. That'd be great.
Talk zombies.
Oh, that would be
We should get him and Dan Dresner on the show.
He's not allowed to contradict me.
It's a unitary marriage.
You're on my territory now, pal. Ben, you have objects?
I have an object lesson after action report.
Okay.
So last week, as listeners will remember, I talked about Spaceman Eddie, who had sent me a baby Canon pin. I think it's Spaceman Ed. Sent me a baby Canon pin. And impulsively, after I had received it, I ordered 100 of these pins, thinking I was
going to... As one does.
As one does. Thinking I would give them away to people as thank you gifts for, you know, support of Lawfare and that sort of thing. And then over the weekend, I had this brainstorm that maybe I should just tweet out, hey, donate to Lawfare and I'll send you a baby Canon pin. And... So I had ordered 100 of them. We got 300 donations and before we had to cut it off. And so I just want to say, first of all, big shout out to Spaceman Ed for making me think about what we could do with baby Canon pins. And secondly, thanks to everybody who donated to Lawfare. And we actually have to wait to send you your pins until we get the new order of pins because we didn't have enough pins.
That pin factory is going to be happy.
Yeah, they're going to be real pleased with us. So, but we're very grateful to everybody who joined the Hashtag Baby Cannon Society. And I was on Morning Joe this morning talking about impeachment and wearing the Baby Cannon pin.
Nice.
So.
It's a very attractive pin, by the way.
It is. I have to say, I'm really glad that you decided to do this donate to Lawfare and get a pin thing instead of becoming one of those guys who hands out the lapel pin to everybody he meets. Thank you for doing
that. We could just attach it to your business card. That could be your thing.
I could just like give out pins, like Ed Koch used to say, "Hey, how am I doing?"
Yeah,
like, "Hey, you know, here's a Baby Cannon pin." I would become insufferable really fast.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. But Ben's not going to send you any more pins. Well, he might send you.
No, but if you want to give a donation to Lawfare, you know, anyway, there's a
no pin,
the
no
support
money.
Page at Lawfare welcomes you.
Whenever you download the podcast on Stitcher or Instacast or Apple, or there's probably like other ones that I'm not even aware of. Wherever
Google Play,
Google Play, that's right.
You can get Spotify.
Spotify does podcasts now. Go to all of these places, like Johnny Appleseed, spreading your 5-star reviews. Let a thousand flowers bloom. Other mixed metaphors. Weird allusions to
Who
history.
Did our music this week, Shane?
Do it. Our music was performed this week by Sebastian Gorka and the Do Not Admit.
Nice.
Yeah.
No, actually, our music was performed by Sophia Yan. And speaking of sound, special thanks to our sound engineer today, Matthew Kahn, and to our special guest from the Deep State. So glad you were here.
Do you have any words for us, Deep State? Head shaken.
I think we all got the message. On behalf of my good friends, Ben Wittes, Tamar Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you for listening.
Bye.